Today on Against the Grain, what's the value of a liberal arts education? It's become commonplace to hear humanities degrees condemned as a waste of money, purportedly not readying students for the world of work. Scholar and literary critic Gail Green counters that they've never been more necessary, yet are disappearing from higher education. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Gail Green is Professor Emerita at Scripps College, a private liberal arts institution in Claremont, California, where she taught for decades. In her book, Immeasurable Outcomes, Teaching Shakespeare in the Age of the Algorithm, she argues that the humanities at Scripps and across the country are under attack as part of a broader assault on education, devalued for not preparing students for the job market and economic productivity. She suggests that, on the contrary, the humanities have great, unquantifiable value, allowing us to see ourselves, our fellow humans, and the societies we inhabit in all their necessary complexity. When I spoke to her, I asked her to give me her assessment of the state of the humanities and liberal arts education today.
Well, it is not in good shape. When I went to college, about 1 in 5 people majored in English, and today it's maybe 1 in 20, and that's a figure from a few years ago, so it probably is less. Actually, it's been expressed very well in an article by Nathan Heller in The New Yorker. A lot of people have been reading it and talking about it. And it describes the state of things at Harvard and other places. It interviews a lot of students, so the voices of students, which I really appreciated in that article. And what you get, the sense you get, is that all the buzz and all the money is in STEM.
STEM being science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
And that's been the case for a very long time, even though if you look, since Obama, Obama really, and Bill Gates can basically inhabited, controlled Obama's education department, and he was very, very big on pushing STEM. And consequently, you have more computer science majors than there have ever been, you know, than all the humanities combined. Now, that's kind of a problem, considering that technology is now doing major layoffs. 160,000 in the past year or so. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because artificial intelligence is coming along to utterly rock the boat and possibly sink it. And so, it's not so good that people have specialized so narrowly in STEM subjects, but particularly in computer science. Now, the humanities, this is a very long and complicated story, but from the golden age of education, when I went to college, when the humanities had a national mandate, the government was supporting the humanities. The humanities were seen to be the cornerstone of an education, which was the cornerstone of a democracy. And this was the golden age, well named, I think, the golden age of education. Mass affordable education. When the great, the master plan of the University of California, where I went to Berkeley, which, encouraged anyone in the state who was willing to work for it to get, a four-year, for free, for nothing education at the University of California, Berkeley. Well, all of that has changed. Now the defunding, we have been defunded. The defunding made us, raise tuition, and the raised tuition created student debt, which has been such an incredible liability. And naturally, students are eager to go into an area which they think is going to yield them a good salary. And there's enormous negative press against the humanities now. The right wing just loves to bash us. And so things are not looking good right now. And yet, the employability of people who major in English, for example, is actually much better than, you know, the press suggests, because employers are looking for people who can read, synthesize, understand, communicate with other people, work together, analyze problems in a long-term way, think through problems, think through, see the context, understand the consequences. All this stuff comes out of liberal arts courses, and employers appreciate it. It's just that the press has been so bad, and the emphasis is on short term, you know, go immediately into a six-figure salary. I mean, you could probably do that if you get a degree in pharmacology or in accounting sometimes, you know. But these are really short-term skills, and they're not going to provide people with long-term capabilities to survive major upheavals that are coming in the future.
And we'll talk more about the logic that education has to ultimately serve business and lead to trained workers, because you do take on that question in the book. But I wanted to ask you a bit more about the funding within universities for the humanities and what has taken place over what period of time.
It's kind of like this bandwagon effect of universities have been defunded. And then we're called an unsustainable business model. And look at all the student debt and all the terrible things we're doing to society, you know, driving people into debt and making these divisions. You know, we suddenly have these divisions between the college educated and the not educated. So we really, how are we going to fix this? We have been told we need to make ourselves more like business, which we're not. I mean, education simply is not business. It's not a profit-making deal. And its effects, its outcomes are not assembly line. They can't be measurable. They're long-term, and they're human, and they're not measurable, which is why I called my book Immeasurable Outcomes. But the short-term solution to this has been to hire managerial administrators who only understand sort of bottom line thinking. And when enrollment in classics falls or enrollment in philosophy calls, they look at it and they say, oh, not sustainable, let's terminate it. And let's put our resources, let's get another data center. UC Berkeley has just made a huge, there's a new data center there, which, you know, people view with great excitement, but I think, geez, maybe they could have put a little money and muscle into the liberal arts, which they're doing rather well, and Berkeley's doing rather well in humanities enrollments, but the resources are not going there, you know? I mean, the classes are huge. I mean, the professors are dealing with many more students than they had to in my day when I went to Berkeley. Classes were huge, but they're huger now. So the universities are simply not supporting this. They're not behind it. Except some of them are doing small liberal arts, trying to give a small liberal arts experience within the larger thing, which I think is just really admirable and is working very well. So I shouldn't globally, you know, condemn them for putting all their resources into STEM, and it's not simply the way it's working. So it kind of spirals. I mean, so students see this is where the money is and this is where the buzz is, and it's kind of becomes embarrassing. They have to apologize for majoring in the humanities. I never had to do that. I was interested in Shakespeare when I was an undergraduate. What an oddball thing to do. I mean, today, forget it. But, you know, even then it was a little, I did get questions like, what are you going to do with that, you know? It turns out what you can do with an English major is just about practically anything. I mean, it may take a longer time to get there, more circuitous route, but often you get the more interesting jobs. And P.S. the jobs that you actually are satisfied with and feel like you're doing something for the world. I mean, that kind of qualitative measure, you know. You can't measure that stuff. That's the problem, you know. To measure life satisfaction is a very difficult thing to do. To measure starting salaries, which Bill Gates and Obama wants to do, is perfectly, that's easy. You know, that's the easy way out. So there's just an enormous kind of incentive for you, for higher education to be like business. It's not like business. It's really ruining the places, I think, you know, to confine it to this measurable outcome, to this bottom line.
What was your own experience with public and higher education, being born into a very different period, as you've sort of alluded, than students today are?
I was okay with it. I didn't mind huge classes at Berkeley. I knew what I wanted to major in. I always loved literature. It was kind of, there was no competition. I loved reading. I loved writing. I was very self-directed. I had a very supportive family, not far from where I, you know, in, down the peninsula. And they supported. I mean, it was a kind of extraordinary thing for a girl in the, who grew up in the 1950s, essentially, although I was in college in the 60s. But the to be supported, I mean, a lot of females. I mean, the 1950s were not the golden age for females, let's put it that way. But my family wasn't like that. I mean, whatever I wanted to study, they were there. They were the checkbook. And so my experience wasn't really typical, I don't think. I was okay with Berkeley. I didn't mind the anonymity, the huge classes. I liked the charismatic lecturers. But I saw friends of mine at Berkeley just slip between the cracks, you know, have nervous breakdowns, drop out, never be seen again, who couldn't find any way of connecting to the place. I didn't need a connection to the place because I had a connection to literature. And I've seen the difference between a small college experience where I think back on those friends of mine then, and I think at Scripps that wouldn't have happened. That wouldn't have been allowed to happen. They would have found a mentor, a professor who took interest in them. I know this because I've taken interest in some quirky little kids, you know, who needed support and needed somebody to find them interesting, which I did. And then also I saw them find a group of friends at Scripps. I'm talking about the difference between a small liberal arts, you know, college and a huge university. And I think today students need more and more this small experience, education to human scale, where relationship rich, you know, where they form relationships with one another and with professors and mentors. And I know I've seen it happen and it really works. And I know some of the students I've worked with, they wouldn't have survived Berkeley. They wouldn't, they would certainly not survive it today. I imagine it is even more extremely impersonal today and difficult to find, you know, mentors or somebody who, I mean, the faculty is just amazingly overworked at Berkeley. I mean, they have to do everything. And they do not have time. They don't have, because I know them. I mean, I've talked to a lot of them. And my experience teaching, having this rich kind of personal relationship in the small classes allow you, it's just so different. And watching them grow up, you know, and mentoring them and seeing their, helping them access their strengths is just so different from the faculty members I've known at Berkeley. You say, God, you know, I've never seen, they leave my classes, I never see them again, you know. You know, occasionally in a graduate situation, graduate school situation, they get to know and mentor. You know, I shouldn't exaggerate about this, but I think today kids need more than ever. Certainly first-generation students need it. Certainly, you know, students who come from, you know, marginalized situations definitely need this kind of personal relationship-rich education that small classes can provide. I mean, the great universities are great. I have no, I mean, they're just, they do a fabulous job, but they're pulled in, and they also have more research demands on them.
I'm speaking with Gail Green, Professor Emerita at Scripps College. She's the author of Immeasurable Outcomes, Teaching Shakespeare in the Age of the Algorithm. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were just talking about the importance of teaching in what has become a sort of endangered species, a small liberal arts setting, and learning, teaching the humanities and having access to the humanities. And I want to ask you much more about that. But before we do, I would like to ask you about the forces that have made such an education endangered. You talk about a war on education, and I wonder where you pinpoint the changes, where they originate, these changes to higher education, especially to the humanities, especially to liberal arts. At what point did this framework come into play that valued metrics and jobs that are supposed to be highly employable and basically used a economic yardstick for determining the quality of an education?
Yeah, the first shot came from Ronald Reagan. Behind Ronald Reagan, however, was Koch brother money and a cadre of billionaires who decided that mass affordable education was simply getting out of hand, because look what it was doing. It was producing social movements. You know, it was producing people who felt that they had a right to a better life, a living wage. The unions were strong. I mean, we're talking about, you know, in the 60s and then the early 70s. And they also felt that this came out of education, you know. They became educated, and people become educated, they become dangerous because they become critical. As, you know, Frederick Douglass Master said, you know, teach him to read and he'll never be a slave again. And that really kind of is true. And look at, you know, what happened out of the universities in the 60s. I mean, social movements, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and the environmental movement. Okay, so corporate America got kind of scared, and they said, you know, this is going to cost money. I mean, there's a Powell memo, 1971, it's very famous. It said, look, we got to get hold of this, and we have to, you know, the think tanks came out of this. We have to create our own information, you know, machinery, and they did, I mean, very successfully. But Reagan really fired the first overt shot when he said there are certain kinds of intellectual curiosities that we shouldn't be funding. You know, if you want to study Egyptology, go somewhere else. And all the red state governors have been saying things like this ever since. But, you know, Governor Brown, who he ran against, he not only ran against Governor Brown, he ran against the University of California, because the first thing he did when he came in was to fire Clark Kerr. But he, you know, Brown said something like, if we can create a job to fulfill a man, we can create a man to fulfill a job, or something like that. I mean, it was a statement about human fulfillment, that we're not only interested in job creation here, we want to create human beings who are fulfilled. Well, that went out the door with Reagan. But Reagan was kind of a figurehead. I mean, there was so much, there was corporate America behind him, you know, full swing. Anyway, he proceeded to, with Reagan came tuition, which had not existed before. They had fees, but they didn't have tuition. And out of the Reagan administration came a report called A Nation at Risk. That was 1983, and it was one of the first attempts of the government to get a hold of K-12. K-12 was more easily, was a sitting duck compared to higher education. Higher education has a lot of respect throughout the world. K-12 was having a lot of problems because of the wealth gap, which, by the way, it was Reagan who made that wealth gap begin. Before that, a teacher was paid pretty close to what an engineer was paid, pretty close to what an NFL player was paid. I mean, there wasn't this extraordinary wealth gap. We had a middle class. Anyway, so it was Reagan, you know, the gap between rich and poor begins to increase. A Nation at Risk says the schools in our country are so bad, they're deplorable, they're putting the country at risk, national risk, you know, and let's see, a tide of mediocrity. And this is where the teacher bashing begins, which the narrative of the broken schools, which was really about privatization. It was a ploy for privatization, and it didn't take on in 1983. It took a little longer. It took till George W. Bush and No Child Left Behind in 2002, and that moved in with high-stakes, standardized teaching and rigor. You know, we have to have rigor in our schools now, and schools have to be accountable. Well, schools didn't need fixing, you know, they needed funding is what they needed. They needed a lot more resources, human resources. Because of the wealth gap, it created such a discrepancy. It had created an underclass, and teachers couldn't, I mean, you know, teachers aren't psychologists, they're not social workers. I mean, they are, in fact, now. But they suddenly were dealing with problems that were just beyond educational, with social problems. These were social problems, they were not educational problems, but the educational system was being blamed. And that was very convenient, because once you blame something and once you convince the public, and there's an enormous kind of corporate press behind this that's behind reform. The New York Times to this day is a reform cheerleader. Test scores, test scores, test scores, that's all you hear. Well, you know, test scores are actually not a measure of learning. What test scores measure are your zip code. Essentially, there's something called the zip code effect. If you are from an advantaged background, have had SAT, you know, tutors and so forth all along, you're going to test better. So underprivileged kids don't test so well. So let's close the schools, let's privatize them, let's turn them into charters. And, you know, this the tool for doing this is measurement. If you can measure something, you can manage something. And so K-12 is brought into control of, brought under the thumb of government. And the feds have exerted undue control in this. Diane, you could read this in Diane Ravitch's Life and Death of the Great American Schools and Reign of Error. That's the really good one, Reign of Error, where she talks about No Child Left Behind, and these reform, you know, No Child Left Behind was followed by Race to the Top, was followed by the Common Core, which is Bill Gates's gift to the world. I say that with a great deal of irony. But she was a part of the structuring of this No Child Left Behind. She was high up in the Bush administration, in his Department of Education, George W. Bush, she changed her mind. I mean, when she saw that this was about rooting public resources into private interests, it was opening K-12 as a market for industry, testing industries, assessment industries, consultants. There's this whole army of consultants that are barnacled to the school systems and now to higher education, of course, because it's all moved up to higher education gradually. But she changed her mind, and she said, I heard her in Oakland, as a matter of fact, say this. Somebody said, "What made you change your mind?" She said, "I began to see students as human beings, not data points." Because once you evaluate students in terms of test scores, you're simply reducing them, you know, to a data point. I mean, you're not, you know, you don't care about learning, you care about test scoring, and that's what No Child Left Behind and so-called reform has done to public education. Then in 2006, in the reign of George W. Bush, we had the Spellings Report, which did the same thing to higher education that had been done to K-12. I mean, higher education's been harder to get hold of because we have a lot of Nobel Prizes. We still rank highest when, you know, these rankings of the top 50 universities in the world. I mean, we'll be the top 25 or so. I mean, we've got a really good, it didn't need fixing, it needed funding. It never needed fixing. All of this assessment stuff is totally bogus, is totally political. So the Spellings report, Margaret Spellings was Bush's Secretary of Education at the time, said, oh, you know, we're putting the nation at risk. Well, we've heard this before. But we now need assessments. You know, we need some way, and it's a way of getting control. Assessments, and it hit first of all the junior colleges, then it hit the state colleges, rather the community colleges, the state colleges, the state universities, and it hit Scripps College, and that's when I hit the roof. I thought, wait a minute, what are you doing to us? You are trying to get us to turn a human enterprise into a numerical scheme. I'm supposed to evaluate my students as numbers. I mean, isn't that why they come to a place like Scripps, so that they'll be treated as human beings and not data points?
Can you describe the kind of assessments that you were required to do?
If you want a job in higher education, you'd get one more easily as an assessor than as a faculty member, because that's where the jobs are. That's where our resources are going. Our resources ought to be going to teaching, to smaller classes, to better teaching conditions. Instead, we're hiring assessment officers to police us. I can hardly even describe this stuff. It made so little sense to me. It involved spreadsheets. It involved a system of judgment. If you can assign a number to it, if you can measure something, you can manage it. If you can't, it just becomes much more difficult. I mean, measurement is management. You do know the story from the San Francisco City College story. I mean, that was just incredible, that blatant misuse of an assessment system to close down a perfectly functioning and, you know, incredibly valuable asset to the community.
So why do you think there was that shift at a place like Scripps, which is a private liberal arts college, certainly not a cheap place to go? The students there in many ways are, you know, very fortunate to be there given other choices on offer. Why would a place like Scripps be pushing toward assessing outcomes, getting faculty to reduce the so-called performance of students to these measurable metrics? What was behind it?
I don't think they had any choice. I mean, colleges have to be reaccredited every 6 years or so, and there are assessment bodies to do this, and they're regional. And, you know, a committee comes in and, you know, is in charge of this very elaborate process. And the thing is it just got more and more elaborate once the assessment bodies had to jump to the tune of these federal, you know, it's really hard to say. You'd like to be in a back room to find out how this stuff works. But I do know that pressure was put on the regional assessment bodies to create a more elaborate system of assessment as spelled out in the Spellings report. I mean, this was a government report. This was, you know, presidential commission. So the pressure was intensified. I mean, this WASC, it's called, the West Coast Regional whatever, that came in, and we used to call it WASP because it sort of buzzed around and stung for a few months and then it went away. But it became a kind of continuous presence on campus. We were always evaluating ourselves in these elaborately, you know, numerical terms. We had no choice. I mean, I asked once the dean, I said, where does this come from? And she said she really didn't know. But I do know that Pomona's English department, Pomona is probably the most prestigious of the Claremont colleges, refused. They said no, they weren't going to conform to this. And they were made to, they simply couldn't get away with it. I mean, they had to, the next year, they had to go ahead and bend the knee and do it. I mean, you know, you have to be reaccredited every 6 years. And if you don't bend to their specifications, then you are not reaccredited. That means your students don't get, you know, federal, you know, student loans, student funding. I mean, you're utterly dependent on this. And so there really is no choice. But The thing that disappointed me was that there wasn't more faculty resistance. I mean, I seemed to be the only kind of bad apple in the bunch, and or not quite. I mean, there were other cynical voices, but I was kind of more contentious. And I attribute that partly to age, because I remember a time when it wasn't like this. Younger faculty have come up in a world, in a culture of assessment. I mean, and they were not so shocked. They were not so appalled. But when you have turned over authority to outside surveillance, essentially, this is not assessing learning, it is surveying the faculty. It's saying to the faculty, you are accountable to us. Who are we? We're not educators. We've never been in a classroom. We don't know anything but this sort of science-y system that has been devised. You are accountable to us. And this is outrageous, because we are a profession, and the profession is accountable to itself. We're peer-reviewed. You know, that's what peer review means. It means that we're reviewed by our peers, by other people who have written books and who understand, you know, what teaching is, not from people who come from the outside. That's control, and that's surveillance. And I could not make that. And, you know, I mean, what's online with that? What's at stake is academic freedom, you know. And academic freedom is about the production of new knowledge. And it's what higher education is about, you know. I mean, it's not for nothing that a profession is self-governing. A profession is, I mean, we're obviously accountable to laws and to regulations. I mean, yes. But this was something new. This was something coming in. It was a control scheme. Just as I finally realized when I researched the book, that this had kind of crept up from K-12, kind of like a gangrene up the system. But, you know, a place like Scripps, it's utterly absurd. Places that are accountable to the public, you know, when I first heard about this, I said, well, they're not going to touch us. We're a private school. You know, we're not accountable to the legislature. Oh, well, I mean, the law comes in different forms. I don't know, in some ways, you could understand it more in a state system where you have, like, certainly a Republican legislature where you say, okay, dollars in, dollars out. How much does the public get for its investment in public education? You know, we want state employees. Well, good. Good luck forcing them to stay in the state if they get a lucrative degree and want to leave. You know, are you going to control that? But, you know, we want the governor of North Carolina butts with jobs. That was the way he described students. I'm going to fund butts with jobs. I don't want just butts and seats. I want butts with jobs. That's the way students are being. Talk about data points. You know, that's not even a data point. It's just a butt.
Now, at a place like Scripps, as you say, Scripps is somewhat unusual as a private liberal arts college. But obviously, one of the enormous trends within higher education has been the move to replace tenured faculty with contingent faculty. Was that something that was at play here? And if not, how does that sort of relentless push to assessment play out when the faculty do not have the security of tenure?
Well, that's also, you know, the managerial administrator. I mean, I'm not anti-administration. Mind you, some of my best friends are administrators. And a good administrator is worth their weight in gold. I mean, but a good administrator comes up through the ranks, understands something about the profession, you know, teaching and writing, and is genuinely representative of the institution, not of, you know, financial exigencies, you know, from without. So what happens with, you know, when enrollments in classics fall, as I said, you know, then you terminate you not only terminate the classics department, you terminate the tenured faculty. And with the tenured faculty goes the faculty line and goes tenure itself, you know. And yes, it's this bottom line mentality. It's this, you know, dollars in, dollars out. I mean, classics is not bringing in a lot of money. It's not bringing in grant money. And where are the students going? Nobody really cares where the students are going. See, that's the the real tragedy of all this is it deflects attention. We should be paying attention to our student outcomes. I mean, that's a legitimate thing to ask. You know, who and what are we turning out into the society? What is our return on investment? But those are qualitative and not quantitative, and they're long-term, and this is a society that's just absolutely hung up on short-term. You know, show me the dollar, show me the money. And, you know, our students go out and they make a democracy. They're human beings. They learn how to vote. They learn how to read. They learn how to not be, you know, bamboozled, manipulated. But those are human outcomes. So somebody who comes out of a classics department may not go into a six-figure salary, but they may know something that makes them an incredibly valuable, you know, citizen. But this is lost. Nobody cares about this anymore. And this, in fact, is the primary reason for education. You're turning out, you're educating human beings who are capable of participating in a society that is self-governing, is a democracy, not an authoritarian, you know, not following the strong man. I mean, these are really huge stakes, and they're lost when you put a short-term numerical value, starting salary. Okay, these are Gates' standards, and he's got a document going around Congress right now. I shouldn't say he, I should say the Gates Foundation, but we know that behind the Gates Foundation is Bill Gates. And it's called Equitable Value, and it's to educate Congress what is the dollar value of an education, and that is measured by, you know, speed to graduation, how many graduate, what is their starting salary, what is their social mobility, how long does it take them to pay back loans. You know, let's not look at why they have the loans in the first place, because the colleges have been defunded and they have to up their tuition. Let's not look at anything but these small monetary returns. That you lose sight of the larger picture, which is you're trying to graduate human beings who will lead lives that they like, for one thing. I mean, people are not exactly happy in a society right now. The quality of life is going down. The mortality rate is going up, and not just because of COVID, but because of deaths by despair. We never had that term before, deaths by despair. And I mean, the quality of life has been, we plummet. I mean, the U.S. does not measure up well in studies of this. So we're trying to turn out students, people, who will live good lives, lives they like and do not wish to terminate by suicide or drugs, you know, anytime in the near future. That's a huge thing. But who also know how to read the world, to read what they read, for one thing. I mean, so that they're not, you know, utterly persuaded by corporate media or by social media. But to also understand people's agendas, you know. I don't think we've ever been so barraged by people who want to sell us something or sell us, you know, a way of looking at, you know, an ideology. Influencers, public relations, advertising, you know, vote for me. I mean, and we have to know how to sort out information from misinformation. You can learn that reading a Shakespeare play. You'd just be amazed at what you can learn reading a Shakespeare play because, for one thing, they're hard, you know. So they have to learn to pay, students have to pay attention, they have to focus, they have to learn to, you know, remember what came before and the scene before. But also, this is a really fascinating thing about Shakespeare's tragedies, is that they are about characters who read badly.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Gail Green about her book, Immeasurable Outcomes, Teaching Shakespeare in the Age of the Algorithm. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's Professor Emerita at Scripps College, where she taught for 40 years. And Gail, you argue in your book that a good education is not something that we can measure in these assessments, but that on the other hand, can be described, as you do extensively in your book. Can you tell us about the complexities of teaching in the classroom and why teaching is an unquantifiable art?
I hadn't really thought much about teaching until I began to think about this subject, because I'd done it so long. I mean, I started teaching when I was 23, and I was just thrown into the open admissions program in New York, the CUNY system, and I don't think teaching can be taught. I think teaching is something you learn for yourself, and I did over the years. And when I stopped to think about what is involved in teaching a class, I realized how very complicated it is. I mean, you are dealing with a small class. I'm talking about a discussion class. You have a huge variety of students. I mean, you think of a place as Scripps as a kind of homogeneous place. Well, it's really not. I mean, it's got kids who are, you know, need to be sort of damped down, kids who need to be brought up, kids of enormously various backgrounds, class backgrounds, preparation, goals, aspirations, and you're dealing with all this stuff, and you're also dealing with a very complicated, complex text. And it's really like, I don't know, I've never conducted a symphony orchestra, so I probably shouldn't use this analogy, and I've never driven a team of horses either, so that's probably, but I feel that it is sort of like that. I mean, it's very complicated and fine-tuned and nuanced, and I thought, my God, if it's like this at Scripps, when I started analyzing it, it became quite interesting. I wish I'd done this years before, actually, because it's a very fascinating subject. But I thought, this teacher bashing is so unfair. I mean, if it's this complicated at a place like Scripps, where students are there supposedly by choice, what is it like for a K-12 teacher who's just got everybody, you know, just everybody in the class? They don't want to be there. Some of them don't want to be there. The unfairness of the teacher bashing. And, you know, it is not perceived as an art, but teaching really is an art. And it's also a profession. And it's so, you know, disrespected. But the other thing is to demand a student learning outcome, a self-assessment or an assessment from an officer, you know, is not, you can't do that. I mean, because you actually don't know what you've accomplished in the course of a semester. Students don't know what that, you know, I mean, I've had students who've written me years later and say, you know, I'm really sorry. I didn't understand why you asked us to watch 6 film versions of Hamlet, you know, and I remember that evaluation. It really slammed me, you know, for doing that. They don't know what they've gotten out of a course until years later. And you get these emails that say, you know, I've really been thinking about what you said about Lear or something like that. And it's very gratifying that. But, you know, again, the demand for numerical assessment, which occurs right away, you know, as do student evaluations. Student evaluations occur, you know, you ask them to write the last day of class. And they often have no idea. They're anxious about the final. Their new roommate doesn't have to take a final, and so they're, you know, angry at you for that or whatever. Also, they're incredibly biased. Student evaluations are not trustworthy in the sense that white young males do way better than persons of color or women. So that's a huge problem. I mean, how to assess teaching is extremely difficult. I mean, it's something that is sort of known at a small college. You kind of know who's doing their work, who's successful. You kind of know it. You kind of know it by the end of the day, actually. It comes from what you hear students, what you overhear, I mean, so forth and so on. It cannot be numerically assessed. And yet, I mean, of course, we try. I sympathize with the effort to try, but I don't sympathize with the effort of the way it's done numerically. I think people have to be much humbler about that than they are.
Well, tell us about teaching Shakespeare in particular. You mentioned earlier Ronald Reagan talking about these sort of intellectual extravagances or some phrase to that effect that could be dispensed with, that, you know, are a costly and non-necessary part of education. And I would imagine that the teaching of Shakespeare's plays could, very well fall into Ronald Reagan's category. As someone who taught Shakespeare over many years at a small liberal arts college, what did you see to be the value of that kind of education?
Right. Shakespeare kind of grows with you. I mean, the older you get, the more you appreciate about him. It was an odd attraction when I was young to go into this field. I just knew that he dazzled me. I mean, there was just nobody like him. Nobody did that kind of thing with language. I also loved some of the films, to tell you the truth. I continued to take more and more Shakespeare courses, and then before I knew it, I was writing my dissertation. And I got in a classroom, and I knew too much to be very good. I wasn't entirely coherent. The first time I taught Lear, I said, well, this is a play about the decline of feudalism and the rise of capitalism, which it is, but that really doesn't wake them up in the back rows. So you have to start with something like, how does it feel when somebody asks you, how much do you love me? That kind of gets their attention, because that's an uncomfortable thing. That's, of course, the way the tragedy of Lear begins. But the more I taught him, the more I realized, my God, this guy is, he's just absolutely essential to everything. I mean, first of all, humanism. Shakespeare is he's a dramatist in which people are related to one another in a social network, and the characters we love and admire are characters who love one another and are loyal to one another. And the villains are characters who, I am myself alone. I am dependent on no one. Kind of like our heroes are today, the Ayn Randian hero of self-sufficiency. Those are Shakespeare's villains. So there's this humanistic sensibility of society, of relationships, of characters related to one another in a mesh of human network. And that's a really important thing to get across in an age of neoliberalism, where, we are all self-reliant and ourselves alone without being beholden to anyone. Another thing that's really fascinating to me is that the tragedies are about characters who read badly. They're confronted with situations that, because of certain blind spots about themselves, they're not able to judge. They're not able to read the motives of other people, and they're easily manipulated. And this is, King Lear listens to the wrong daughters. He succumbs to flattery. So does Brutus. He's seduced into a political coup for which he is completely, he has no sense of the consequences of it. He has no sense of his own capabilities. The old adage, know thyself, it's really, really strong in these plays. Macbeth, he listens to the wrong person. Othello listens to the wrong person. They're manipulated because of certain blind spots about themselves. They don't read well. They don't read themselves. They don't read the world. They don't hear the true meanings of the words of others. That's really important for students to see. They're really object lessons in poor reading. this is kind of the root of unhappiness and misfortune. And also, the plays are plays. They're fun. Shakespeare was really, he was a playwright. He was a player. He was an actor. He knew that you had to please in order to attract audiences, for audiences to come back. And if you can get that across, which you can have students perform Midsummer Night's Dream, which is just full of laughs. They get it. They get it. This is fun. This is a play, And so they loosen up and they take more risks in the classroom discussion, and they see the fun and the humanity of it, and that's enormously important. Now, you can't do that with Henry James, there's just a lot of writers who are kind of inert on the page, and Shakespeare is not for the page, he's for the stage, and so you can bring him alive in ways that make his very important, I don't want to call them messages, because I don't think great literature has messages, but it certainly has a moral sense, and Shakespeare has a very deep moral sense. He's a humanist, and humanism is in severe decline, shall we say. We never really achieved it. And it's an important part of my class, I think an important part of a liberal education, is to get across certain humanist values, that we do not exist alone. We exist in relation to other people. We have certain responsibilities to others. What happens to me affects you. What happens to you affects me. You cannot put a shackle around a man's ankle without shackling yourself to it. To see society as a knit organism, it's something I think is really valuable. I mean, students have to know this. Their parents are often so distracted and so pulled so many ways. You know, where are they going to get it except the classroom, the humanities classroom, and talking with one another after class, which I always love to hear would go on, you know. Hey, we talked about this in the dorm that night. I mean, great. That's what's supposed to happen. It's supposed to be a synergistic response that goes on through life.
Gail Green, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Sasha.
Gail Green is an author and literary critic, professor emerita at Scripps College. We've been discussing her book, Immeasurable Outcomes, Teaching Shakespeare in the Age of the Algorithm. That's published by Johns Hopkins Press, and you can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. Her other books include Missing Persons and Insomniac. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.